This is 90.3.
This is Real FM. And you are very welcome back to the second half of the Tuesday edition of Northside Today. This is Donie Tarlin sitting in for Noel McGuinness. And I am delighted to say that joining me in studio is the Solidarity candidate in the Dunamead ward for the upcoming local elections, Michael O'Brien. Michael, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, I'm going to start because, to be fair to all the candidates, I have a kind of a generic program in my head for interviewing so that fairness is transparent and obvious across the board. I'm going to start by asking you the same question that I've asked every other candidate that has been in here and that I've spoken to. Why should the good people of Dunamead vote for Michael O'Brien?
Well, I think the people of Dunamead and the other areas that are within the Dunamead ward should vote for myself on the basis of my record as a councillor for the last 5 years and an activist for the last 27 years and all the key struggles and issues that have come up in the area that are sometimes national issues as well, going back to the time of the property tax and water charges and the organising role that I played around that, which was very important in stemming the tide of austerity, because the blows landed hard on working class people in the years from the beginning of the crisis right up until 2014, when people finally had enough. But also on the housing issue as well, which remains largely unresolved. We're going backwards, in fact, on that issue that I think we've been, and I've been, the most clear-sighted among the candidates about the solutions that are required in terms of public housing, strict controls on rents, a ban on economic evictions, a curtailment of the activities of these funds, but also how we actually achieve that under the present government, which is very hostile to those ideas. The need to build a social movement similar to the water charges around that. So, and I've applied myself to that on a daily basis, really, over the last 5 years. While people associate me with the water struggle, that it's actually housing that's been the day-to-day issue that's bear down upon me the most. So I think people will see in me, I hope, good representation for working class people, but also someone who has engages fully in the battle of ideas in Irish society about where we need to go. You know, that we have a Fine Gael government, and it's reflected at local government level. That's very much for pro-privatisation, neoliberal. We see it in our public transport, you know, our hospitals, every sphere of life. You know, we need kind of people that are clear-sighted and standing against that, and who have an orientation to organise working class people themselves to stand up for themselves as well, rather than just saying that we'll go and do everything for you.
Michael, I suppose to a greater or lesser extent maybe, and just the top four items that you mentioned there, it seems to me, as somebody who is a political animal, I suppose, and I absolutely devour it, that these issues have been the same issues that we've been hearing about, I would nearly venture to say, for the last 40 years.
Yeah, I think you're correct, or longer even, depending on which issue you're speaking about.
Like, if you go back further, Michael, sorry for interrupting, yeah, you know, but I mean, at least, if you go back further, we'll say to the early 80s, at least in the 50s, 60s and 70s, we were building local authority houses. You know, people hadn't much, but they had a bit. But the divide between the haves and the have-nots didn't seem to me to be as big then as it is now. Because it seems to me that the more that we modernised and progressed, the people at the bottom of the ladder seem to be getting left further and further behind all the time.
I would agree with you that under the system in which we live, which is capitalism, we're seeing growing inequality within society and obviously on a global basis as well. And to use the housing example, as you say, in decades past, when the country had less money, when there was less economic activity, somehow at the same time public housing in significant quantities was delivered to periodically deal with the housing crises that have you know, been around and have popped up over the course of the last century or so. But really what we see now is more acute as a crisis than ever. And we've gone from a position where local authorities had the capacity to build, you know, had directly employed building labour, to a position maybe 40 years ago in the last significant round of local authority house building, where they would have hired companies to do the building on public land, to a position now where effectively the initiative rests largely with private developers to do the building. And I think we see it on our own doorstep in the northeast of the city, not within the Dunamead ward, but just not too far from it in the Lawrence Lands at the end of the Oscar Traynor Road. It's a perfect case study of the wrong approach to public housing, that there you have a piece of council-owned land upon which you could fit some 600 units. And rather than the council optimising the land it owns to build social and affordable units as well, because they're forbidden from raising the finance themselves because of EU fiscal rules, instead what they do is that they invite private developers to come in and raise the finance in the first place and then do the building. But because it's the developers that raise the finance, that they're given an added incentive by the council, that when they build those 600 units, they get to keep 70% for themselves to sell basically for a profit, and the city only gets 30% of those units on its own land. And if those examples are replicated around Dublin and beyond, I mean, how the hell are we ever going to get on top of the housing crisis? So if you like, the very bad approaches that are being taken now that are unprecedented, really, like in the history of the state, and it amounts to a giveaway of a public asset and in a context of growing our waiting list, is completely wrong.
Michael, you are a sitting Dublin City Councillor, yes?
Mm-hmm, correct.
I saw a figure yesterday which absolutely stuck me to the ground. We need 80,000 social or affordable houses in Dublin alone. Let's be honest, there isn't a snowball's chance in hell of that happening.
Well, I would disagree that it is possible. It is possible to build that quantity of housing in Dublin City and County. I mean, for example, in the last year of the boom before the crisis kicked in, so we're talking about the year 2006, I think, there were 94,000 units built right across this state. So I don't think anybody's arguing for 80,000 to be built in Dublin in 1 year. But certainly you could have a multi-year plan and targeted, you know, state investment to raise the finance. And the thing is that the resources are there because this government has already committed to the housing assistance payment, where people can get HAP approval of up to $2,000 a month now. That's money that goes directly to the landlord. And Dr. Rory Hearn, an academic out in Maynooth University, he worked out that over a 15-year period, the billions that are spent on the HAP could be used to build public housing in the state. There's enough land zoned in the Dublin City Council area for some 52,000 units. And of that, about 14,000 could be built on council-owned land. But if you take the other three local authorities, Fingal especially, which has a lot of green area, and South Dublin County Council as well, and other institutionally owned lands, like in other words, not from the council, but other branches of the state, whether it's the HSE, RTE, CIE, and so on, that it is entirely possible to build those units. And it would be entirely comparable with what was achieved in decades past in this state. Now, the thing is that the government and others would like us to think that these things are so impossible that we give up hope, and if we give up hope, well, then we won't campaign and fight for it. But that's where the battle of ideas comes in, that you have to give people the vision and the facts and the figures that actually these things are achievable, but we have to go out and fight for them.
But Michael, surely that's like trying to service an Airbus A380 in flight, because if you divert the money that is currently being spent on HAP, which I agree with you, of course, mm-hmm. I mean, every time that payment goes up miraculously and coincidentally, so do the rents, but that's an aside. But if you divert that money away from the HAP in towards a building programme, where are you going to get the money to keep the people for whom those houses are being built would have to be accommodated while the houses are being built? Where are you going to get the money to pay for that accommodation?
Well, it's a fair question, and it shows that you need an integrated solution to the housing crisis in this country. And you need a suite of measures, like if you were to divert resources or apply resources, and assuming that there is this zero-sum game, that money spent on house building is not money being spent on HAP, well, then that poses the need for strict rent controls on our landlords. If some of those landlords are accidental landlords, well, then that actually poses a knock-on question about, if you like, the legacy of Celtic Tiger era mortgage debt and the break that those people didn't get. So you have to deal with that question as well. So the other point I would make is that in terms of where the resources are going, that we have private developers sitting on land banks. There's been an effective strike of investment in the sense that it is reckoned now that if you take Dublin City and County as a whole, of all of those people that have an unmet housing need, so that's not just people on the housing list, but it's those that are in the locked out generation, some of the half a million young adults, 20s, 30s, even early 40s that are stuck with their parents, people from all walks of life that have an unmet housing need, they reckon that currently only the top 20% earners among those people actually have the ability to get mortgage approval at this point in time. Only the bottom 20%, such are the low income thresholds to make you eligible for public housing, only the bottom 20% of those earners can apply for public housing. And then you have this middle wedge of 60% that are betwixt and between. They can neither get mortgage approval nor can they apply for public housing. Now, the developers in this country at this point in time, they're only content to build at a piecemeal basis to satisfy the top 20% of earners. And then the problem we have is that such is Dublin's reputation for rapidly rising property prices and high rents that now we've become a magnet for the wrong kind of investment. For example, if you take Marshfield Avenue in Clongriffin, there's a row of blocks under construction there since last autumn. Now, no sooner were the foundations laid down on those blocks of apartments than last October, a London-based fund called Tristan Capital Partners bought the lot for 130 million euro. That's 350 grand a piece. And because of the way they organise their tax affairs, they won't be paying very much tax in this state. Now, how is a couple or an individual that actually can get mortgage approval up to 350 grand meant to compete with that? They can't. But it gets worse because there's three live planning applications in the last couple of weeks in our immediate vicinity here in the northeast of Dublin. The Chivers Jam Factory site on Greencastle Avenue, 495 units, built to rent, and mostly studio apartments and one bedrooms. The Clare Hall Tesco's beside there, a 9-storey, again, preponderance of studios and one beds and build to let. And then the latest one is the Columban site on the Dunamead roundabout, another build to rent. So we're going to turn a generation of people in this state into absolute rent slaves. But the point is that there's money washing around the system here. You take bespoke student accommodation. That's another one as well, that between the canals in this city, they reckon that by 2022, I think there'll be 15,000 units of dedicated so-called student accommodation. Now, there was a report done recently by Dublin City Council on this purpose-built student accommodation. And what the report showed is that 80% of the occupants, the current occupants, 12,000 or so in those units, are international students, right? But 80% of those international students are from outside the European Union. And what does that mean? The significance of that is that those students pay the top range of fees, up to 50 grand. They're the sons and daughters of the international elite. And then if you find out why are they bringing... People are competing, if you like, with other educational institutions the world over to bring those students in. It's because of the high fees, and it's to do with the funding crisis in our universities. Because the report quoted from the Irish Universities Association, where they refer to those international students as a form of foreign direct investment. So the point I'm making here is that there's a lot of economic and construction activity happening. I haven't even gotten onto office space. 8.6 billion euros has been invested in commercial office space. There's a raft of a construction activity and investment happening across Dublin City and County, where it's the wrong type of accommodation, if it's accommodation at all, relative to the needs that are out there and being unmet. And I think the point is that her conclusion from all of that is that a massive state intervention is needed, to including the nationalisation of some of the available development land, and a state-led programme of home building construction that actually meets the needs of people. Because, if you like, the workforce is there and the materials are there.
What is it, Michael? Yeah. I mean, this is the issue. And I mean, you know, not to cut across you because you're in full flow there, but I'm conscious of time. Mm-hmm. Number one, what I would say to you is that unless I'm greatly mistaken, the biggest landowner in Dublin is Dublin City Council.
It's up there, yeah.
They own the most of the green areas that we see. I think the corporation, their workforce was depleted during the recession.
Correct.
I still, and I'm offering an opinion here, and I'd be interested, and I want to move on from the housing issue, because we could spin from now till Christmas. You'd miss the election talking about it. There's that much to say in relation to it. But if you look at Ireland Inc. as a whole, I mean, there was a figure produced yesterday again which shocked me, that there was only 27,000 houses in the entire country for rent on the 1st of May of this year, which is shocking.
2,700.
Worse.
Yes.
That's worse, you know, which is shocking. But my argument or my point is, if you are a fully qualified tradesman in the building profession, be you in England, be you in Germany, be you in Australia or Canada, which I think is, if you want to take it worldwide, that's probably where the bulk of them are, and you are in your late 20s, early 30s, with a partner, maybe one, two small children, you look across the Atlantic or look across the Irish Sea, there's absolutely no incentive for you to come back to this country. Would you agree?
Yeah, for nurses, for all walks of life, it's absolutely the same. So in terms of how we get ourselves out of this situation, that there's no piecemeal measures that are going to do that, that we need a state construction firm that's going to be appealing, pays the trade union rates and so on, and offers job security, because people see that they're going to work for an enterprise that's going to has years ahead of it to try and address these situations. But these are the measures that are necessary to kind of address this situation, because the problem is that this is not a problem that stands still. We're going backwards on a daily basis. Rents are getting higher. The built space of Dublin has been taken up with the wrong kind of stuff. And house prices are getting higher as well. And then there's also the health and mental health cost and toll on people as well. Like, there's a lost decade behind us, like, on this. Do we have another lost decade ahead of us by not actually doing the radical socialist measures, I would say, that are necessary to alter the situation?
Mick, we're going to leave housing there, and as I said, we could be here until next Christmas, and we still wouldn't cover all the various aspects of it. Something which I know is very close to your heart, and which was a major, major worry for your constituents, particularly in Dunamead, public transport.
Definitely, yeah, and particularly Eden Moor, I would say, and the Bus Connect proposals that came out summertime last year, which I described as kind of a rearranging of the deck chairs, in the sense that the Bus Connect proposal, if you were to sum it up in a nutshell, was about tilting the available buses more towards the needs of working commuters, but doing so at the expense of the services going into residential areas, particularly, you know, kind of older residential areas around Dublin. And in terms of how it manifested itself in the Dunamead ward, was a 27A bus. They were proposing that a service would replace that would follow some of the route of the old 27A from Blunden Avenue, drive through around Eden Moor and so on through Harmonstown. But that at the Artane roundabout, instead of going into town, it would head on to Beaumont Hospital, and that commuters would have to get off at Gracefield Avenue, walk up to the Artane roundabout and get a bus into town. And I think people's experience was that, you know, especially given that they weren't promising any more buses, that they would be trying to get onto buses that would be full coming down the Malahide Road. It went down extremely negatively in Eden Moor. We had a public meeting last July, I think it was, that was extremely well attended. And, you know, and I want to thank the Residents Association in Eden Moor, who I worked alongside, like, and who, but between us, we marshalled a massive amount of submissions. And there were similar initiatives in working class communities all over Dublin, and even not so working class communities as well, because I think it went down negatively in lots of different areas. And the National Transport Authority say that they were so overwhelmed by the amount of feedback they got, official feedback on the forums and online as well, by the deadline, which I think was around October last year, that whereas they promised to give us feedback and a response in a second round of consultations in January, we still haven't heard back from them. Now, the feedback will come after the local elections, and we have to see, but I'm quietly optimistic that I think we've managed to organise the opposition in even more sufficiently that I think a city centre route will be safeguarded.
Yeah, and that's vitally important, because there were some proposals in that, and I mean, I'm not here to pontificate or, you know, come down on one side or the other, because that's not my job, but I would have to say that I saw some of these proposals and I studied them and spoke to people in relation to them, and some of the proposed changes, in my opinion, were going to be extremely detrimental to the elderly who were used to a bus service in their area. That was one aspect of it. Now, I want you to kind of clarify two aspects. That's one aspect of it, Michael. But then there was this proposal of a sort of a, it's going to sound daft, but a kind of a, an inner city yet orbital route where your bus that you normally got from any of the areas here, be it Edenmore or Coolock or Riverside or anything that would have initially brought you into the city centre, that was going to stop. It was going to bring you down to somewhere around Drumcondra or Dorset Street, and you got off of that bus and you waited, and then another bus came to bring you the rest of the ways into the city centre. Like, it made no logical sense at all, so most of it.
Yeah, Jared Walker was the international transport consultant who was brought in to make this proposal, and I think bus drivers who I'm acquainted with, who themselves involved themselves in the campaign of response to the Bus Connect proposals, made the point that Jared Walker's proposal may make a degree of sense in cities that are based on a grid system, but obviously Dublin is a medieval
city. That was the point. So he's American, if memory serves right. And if it's like, as anybody who has ever been to particularly New York, it makes perfect sense there because it's all straight lines intersecting one another. Dublin is not that. It's a medieval city, let's be honest.
I think in the New World, where cities were kind of planned from 19th century onwards, that's the case, but certainly not in Dublin. I mean, the problem as well is that it's predicated on the idea of high frequency and changeovers and so on. But like what they weren't grasping is that Dublin has expanded rapidly, not just population-wise, but in terms of its footprint. It's a more spread-out city, and it just hasn't been a commensurate expansion of the bus fleet. And I think that's where we need to go with this, because we have major capacity issues with our public transport. Like, when we say we're opposed to the Bus Connect proposals, it's not that we think that the current system is perfect, not just our bus, but also our rail, which is just a major issue as well. Like, in Clongriffin last September, people were greeted with what was packaged as a positive, that the 10-minute DART service, but in reality, again, because they didn't expand capacity, it was like the carriages were shorter, so there was dangerous overcrowding experience last autumn. We had to respond to that as well and get a partial restoration of carriage length and so on. And they say it'll take 3 years because of tendering rules to get things up to spec, and that the consequences that were felt all the way down the line as well. So yeah, public transport, it's a big one, but then the issue of privatisation is mixed in there as well, especially when it comes to the buses. Like, 10% of the routes have gone to go ahead, and more may yet come. So there's battles to be fought on that score as well.
Mick, a lot of time. We have about 4 minutes left. Your manifesto, I have it here in front of me. There's 10 bullet points on it. So I just, we've only really touched on two of them, but you know, they're two pretty important ones. There's one here I just want you to briefly explain. Dezone the St. Paul's site adjacent to St. Anne's Park.
Yeah, that was the Krekoff purchased site that was sold to them by the religious orders there, which was part of the original domain that made up St. Anne's Park, most of which was bequeathed to Dublin Corporation as it was, and is St. Anne's Park. But then you have this adjacent site, which is seen and viewed as part of the domain, but which there's been a number of planning applications for very high-end construction. And it may seem counterintuitive, just given that we've been talking at length about the housing crisis, but like this is a premier public amenity, not just for people in the area, but for the wider community as a whole. And again, it's the wrong site. And the point I made at the time when Krekoff were knocked back, although I'm sure they'll be back with another planning application, maybe slightly modified, is that, there, as we said, there is enough residentially zoned land in Dublin City and County to deal with the housing situation, public, affordable, private, you name it. But that this was a bit of a grab. And I actually brought a proposal to the last development plan process meeting in Dublin City Council to actually have that piece of land zoned as amenity like the rest of the park. And there was a late intervention by the legal officer of Dublin City Council who said that if that motion was passed, the developer would have suffered a financial loss, and that all of us councils who voted for it would have been liable to be sued. Now, unfortunately, that served to frighten a number of councils, and my proposal was defeated. But I intend to bring it again and have that legal advice queried, because do we live in a local democracy or don't we?
Michael, last point. We have a minute and a half left. we're back to what some commentators, I'm not of course saying that it's me, mm-hmm. but they would describe as this utopian lefty happy policy of reinstating council waste collection services funded through progressive taxation and free at the point of use. Bottom line, Michael, outside of progressive taxation, nothing in life is free. Somebody has to pay for it.
Well, yeah, nothing is free at the point of use is a term that's used to describe how public services ought to be delivered. And basically it's linked to people's ability to pay. Hence, it's true progressive taxation. I think the privatisation of our waste services has been an absolute disaster. It began with the commodification of the service when bin charges were introduced. We have problems with, you know, illegal dumping and all the rest.
In relation to that, Michael, one question. Where are you on an idea of where there is large-scale illegal dumping, or even, you know, the person dropping off the odd bag of rubbish on the footpath or the sofa left out overnight, on installing CCTV cameras and following and prosecuting people who are littering our streets?
Yeah, I don't defend illegal dumping and it should be investigated, but the problem is that to get to the root of this issue, this is a problem that has emerged in a particular context, and it would be eliminated if waste was decommodified and run as a public issue. Well, then, you know, that problem would be greatly alleviated, because, you know, there would be no perverse incentives for people, for whatever reason, and I don't defend it, to go and dump their waste absolutely illegally. I mean, just on the point about utopian socials or whatever, I mean, I will say this, is that, you know, we haven't even gotten onto the environment. I'm very heartened by the school student movement around climate change. Ireland is due to be fined, I think, 200 million, is it, by 2020, and up to billions more by the end of the next decade. And issues around public transport and all the rest of it, like, it's all linked into the environment as well. And therefore, when it comes to utopian, like the survival of our planet is actually at stake here, like within the next half generation. So I think very radical measures are required. Like it's all or nothing, really. You know, that's the way I approach my politics.
Michael O'Brien, solidarity candidate in the Dunamead ward in the upcoming local elections. Thank you so much for coming in, Michael. I will get you to finish off, as I have with all the other candidates, date and time of polling.
Okay, polling is Friday the 24th of this month, May, from 7 a.m. I think till 9 or 10 p.m. I'm not really sure. I think it's 10 p.m. You might correct me on that. Just to say that people ought to get a polling card, but even if you don't get a polling card, it doesn't mean that you're not on the register, particularly if you're on the supplementary register. So just bring photo ID with you, and you ought to get your polling card.
It's been a pleasure, Michael, and the best of luck to you in the forthcoming election. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.